Hello and welcome, everyone. I am Jake Wurzak, and this is Masters of Moments. This podcast features conversations with the top entrepreneurs and business leaders around hospitality, real estate, investing, and company building. Thank you so much for joining me and enjoy the show. You've heard it on the podcast so many times, and I'm going to say it again. Relationships are everything in real estate. At Dove Hill Capital Management, one of the most interesting things about our track record is that the majority of the deals have come to us off market or lightly marketed. So we had this innovative idea a few years ago, and that was to launch the Deal Rewards Program at Dove Hill Capital Management. If you want to learn more, you can go to www.dovehillcos.com. Again, that's www.dovehillcos.com. You click on the little deal rewards icon and you can sign up. And if you have a deal that's off market that somehow came to you, maybe you're working on a deal, you're trying to put it together, bring it to us because we can help you get that deal done through our deal rewards program. We offer industry-leading incentives. We'll allow you to co-invest in the deal. We could come up with another interesting structure to allow you to do the deal with us. The Deal Rewards Program is incredibly unique and will give you an opportunity to do a deal with Dove Hill, either in a completely passive position or maybe you're taking a more active role. Either way, please check out the Deal Rewards Program at www.dovehillcos.com. Appreciate it. And this is how we've been getting our flow. The team at Wurzak Hotel Group is just firing on all cylinders right now. So I am very, very excited and proud to announce that we now have a third-party management program where we are managing hotels for other owners. We used to just manage hotels for ourselves, and now we've made some tremendous forward investments in people, our team, technology, accounting, finance, and most importantly, culture. And we are prepared to bring that out to everyone. Our team is experienced in managing independent hotels, branded hotels. We have focused heavily on boutique, lifestyle, and experiential hotels. And we're ready to manage a hotel for you. So if you are interested, if you want to learn more about what we do and how we can help your hotel, please visit wurzakhotels.com. My conversation today is with Mark Brugger, president and CEO of Diamond Rock Hospitality, a publicly traded hospitality REIT. I've known Mark for some time. We're actually in YPO form together, and he has been incredibly impactful for my career. And I am really honored to share this conversation with Mark today. We discuss how he started in hospitality, transitioning from law school to the business world, to brokerage, then to Marriott, then to founding Diamond Rock. We go into what their strategy is today, how they've differentiated themselves as a REIT, how Mark thinks about investing and allocating capital, their investment horizon, which is long-term, and how that compares to a private equity short-term model. We talk about how they think about spending dollars, capital expenditures. We talk about how he makes investments and what he's looking for today and what his competitive advantages are in the space. We also go into how they select management companies because REITs can't manage their own assets and what makes a good manager, what makes a bad manager, what data Mark is looking at on a daily basis to get the pulse on his industry, how he set up the REIT in order to get data and make decisions. It's an awesome conversation. Check out Diamond Rock. Their portfolio is fabulous. Please enjoy my conversation today with Mark Brugger. I thought a good place to start would be to talk about how you and I met and look at it in the context of your style and how you approach business and relationships. So most of you don't know this, but Mark and I are in a forum together. We're both in YPO and we're in this hospitality forum. And I kind of think of it as a little small mafia group of our competitors, our friends, but it's been the most helpful thing that I can point to in my career. And the hardest times in our business, I've relied on the 7 or 8 folks in the forum, Mark being one of them. And my approach has kind of always been to try and help others, and the opportunity is bigger than the amount of people there, so we might as well see everyone else succeed. But maybe you can talk about, Mark, your style and how relationships have impacted your career and your life?
Yeah, I think relationships are one of the wonderful things about being in the hotel industry and hotel real estate. I was previously in residential real estate. I was in multifamily real estate for a while, and there's nothing like hotels where there's a connectivity and a kind of a common community. Because we go to the same events, so many people have gone through the same two or three colleges, so many people have circulated through Marriott or Hilton, go to the same conferences every year. There's just a lot more connectivity in hotels than almost any other aspect of real estate. And I think our YPO group that we met in Forum is just, you know, it's emblematic of that. It's a smaller supportive group, but it's because I think our industry is more connected. It's a people industry. Yeah, you can be very successful in other types of asset classes. It's very hard to be successful in the hotel world without understanding people. It's a people business, right? At the hotel, the operations are a people business. Doing deals is a people business, and it's a repeat business, right? It's the same people over and over over a 30-year career that you're going to interact with. Our little group, I think, is great. I think it's kind of the combination of both that culture and hospitality, as well as the overlayer of the culture that's in YPO, which is really, I think, the kind of genesis of YPO as a professional organization, but supporting leaders, because often leaders are a little lonely at the top, and having that people similarly situated to be able to compare notes with that don't have a stake essentially in the outcome, but have a stake in who you are and seeing you be successful. It's a really wonderful resource and combination of interest that work really well to align to be productive.
Is there something you've learned about people that you think is kind of been one of the keys to your success in deal making?
I think two things on the people front. One is my career has been made by two or three mentors over a 30-year period. But I think I had this great piece of advice that I got years ago in negotiations when dealing with people. And I think when I was very young, I was very aggressive. But the piece of advice which I got when I was probably about 30, which really resonated with me, at the end of a deal, you want to have negotiated hard enough, but not been such a jerk that the other side wants to hire you. And that's always been kind of my way to calculate it, right? If you're too easy, they wouldn't want you to work for them. And if you're too much of a jerk, they wouldn't want you to work for them. But if they want to hire you at the end of the deal, then you know you've kind of gotten that right. And I think that's that's always been my philosophy since then, of trying to negotiate with that style, that you're hard enough that people think you're a good negotiator and that you're an advocate for your positions, but you're not a jerk.
We found our best lawyers that way. It's like, you know, some guy is opposite the table of you on a deal and they're represented by a great counsel. You're like, oh, I'm hiring them next time we're doing
exactly.
A deal.
Right. That's exactly the style, right? If you want to hire them, that's someone that's very good at their job.
How did you transition and why did you transition from residential real estate into hospitality?
So try to make it succinct. So I was a philosophy major undergrad. I was a lawyer. During law school, I worked for my second summer, which is your big summer. I worked for the biggest firm in the world at the time. And I worked for the group that was in California representing real estate developers. And I came back after that summer saying, I didn't want to be a lawyer. I want to be a real estate developer. Sent my resume to everyone in DC. I got a job with Brookfield. It was called Koskin at the time, but doing residential development and acquisitions for them. Worked the balance of my law school with them, took the bar and did that afterwards, which was great. I really enjoyed that. And then after a couple of years of doing that, I got the advice from a local CEO of kind of, if you want to be, my question was, how do I get to sit in your chair? You know, and his advice is, you got to go one of two paths, Mark. You either need to get very close to the finance and the money, or you got to get very close to the set of opportunities, which I think is still great advice, which I've repeated dozens of times over the years. So with that advice, I quit my job and became a commercial broker doing residential apartment buildings in downtown DC to get close to the opportunities. And that was a great job. I love that job. I was a top producer my first year, got big checks. I thought that was terrific. And I did that for a couple of years, two or three years. And the leap over to hotels, I had a friend who had been there, had gone over to work for this new CFO at Marriott, a guy named Arne Sorensen, and he was reorganizing the whole finance group. And they were looking for someone who could come in and monetize all the hotels that they owned. They'd accidentally, I'll say it, accidentally had to own a bunch of hotels through M&A deals or saving contracts. And ultimately, Marriott doesn't want to own any real estate. So I got this call one day. Marriott was located about 2 miles from where my office was at the time. I said, sure, I can't even spell hotel, but I'm happy to go sit and talk to him. And I went in, met with Arne, hit it off. I think I had an offer the next day and was working there 2 weeks later. So I did structured finance for them. Monetizing hotels is kind of my start with them. But that's how I kind of jumped from one to the other to the other. It's really just opportunistic.
I want to take it back when you went to law school. I went to law school too. Is that a path that you would recommend to others? And how do you think it benefited you barely practicing, but taking the time, you know, giving up your prosperous young years to go sit in law lectures? For me personally, it's like a blip on the radar, but was a ton of value. What was it like for you?
Like two separate questions. So my advice generally, people going to law school, it's always a great education. It's not always worth the debt. So if you can afford to go debt-free, I almost always recommend it. If you're going to take on a lot of debt or you have a lot of undergraduate, it puts you in forced choice on career paths, right? If you have to pay off $300,000 or $400,000 of debt, it doesn't give you the opportunity to be an entrepreneur or jump into highly risky jobs because you have that big monthly obligation to repay that debt. So I think those are two different calculations. And so it depends on the situation you start from. My own experience was a little different because I was a philosophy, not a business undergrad. And I think in the law school, I think I'm a huge fan of critical thinking, of liberal arts. I have found, particularly when I was doing structured finance, that being able to think in creative ways, and actually I think I've benefited in my career from not having gone to business school and not having taken traditional business classes, because I would approach things from very different solutions and very different kind of paradigms. And it often led to better results. So I think law school was great for me. I think being a philosophy major was great for me. And I think in a lot of ways, particularly at different intersections of my career, not having the traditional training of business school was actually a huge plus for me.
What made you a successful broker?
Fear. You know, I would call, at the time we had my first kid, I had a negative net worth or basically break even with some law school debt. And I was very aggressive. I would call anyone. I would do anything to get a deal done. You know, all those inhibitions that you have of rejection, you get over very quickly when you have to pay a mortgage. It was a 100% commission job. And I think that fear of failure was just seared into me. And actually, you know, talking about law school as a recommendation, but I think the doing something in sales, particularly where it's a commission job, and particularly if you're under pressure, is a wonderful experience because you get rid of so many of those, I'll call it, inhibitions in talking to people and pursuing things that it gives you an enormous advantage going forward. The lesson I always tell my kid, or the motto, is the world is for askers, which I still believe, you know, to go up and ask, you never know. And you're always stunned how many times people will say yes if you just ask. So the world is for askers is a motto. You know, all my kids would tell you, if you asked them, what does your dad always say? The world is for askers.
Is there something that comes to mind as a moment where still to this day, you're shocked about what you got because of what you asked?
Well, I mean, the company I work for now, I was at Marriott. I was 32 years old and I went into Bill Marriott's office and pitched him that I should be the CEO of this new company. He should give me $45 million. Like, it was a pretty bold ask at the time, but you know, I thought it made sense, but it was still, you know, you think about relative scale to where I was in life, that was a pretty aggressive ask.
So you spent some time at Marriott, which was an asset light model. What did you learn from being in that environment?
Well, I think a lot. So I think one, there's an enormous advantage culturally in ways that I've kind of appreciated more and more as my years have gone on, and just working at a world-class organization. And I got to work with Arne Sorenson at Bill Marriott and Bill Shaw and other leaders there. But I think you gain so much that you don't even know that you're learning. And my experience over the years has been, you know, at DiamondRock has been in hiring people from world-class organizations. They just have good habits that they don't even know that they've learned. And the opposite is us as well. When I've hired some smart people and very good people, but at kind of what I call a little bit dysfunctional or not the best in class organizations, even though these people were really good, they'd kind of permeated some of the bad habits from those organizations. And I had to get them up and retrain them, where when I hire people from, you know, the Marriotts of the world, you know, they just came better prepared with things that they absorbed in the way things should be done. So that was clearly an advantage. I mean, I was very fortunate to work with, you know, it's hard to imagine better leaders than Bill Marriott and Arne Sorenson. So, I mean, I think I would really benefited from being around people that were smart and obviously very good decision makers, very good culture builders. And so I think I learned a lot there. And there's probably things I learned that I'm not even conscious that I learned. And then I would say the other thing, I was, you know, made a lot of, we started the conversation about relationships. I made a lot of great relationships that I still, I was talking to a senior person at Marriott this morning, corresponding, asking for a favor, but it's someone I've known 25 years. You know, those relationships, they're valuable. And, you know, the shared experiences and this shared culture and shared backgrounds, those are all very valuable as you kind of think about building a career.
You're making me think about certain hotels in your portfolio where you've probably had to ask the brands for things, and many other people, they would have said no, but for you, they've said yes on. And to me, that goes back to trust.
Yeah, I mean, I think relationships are part of it. I think again, we're talking about the advantages of having worked there. I think I understand, having worked at a big brand, what's important to them and what's not. And so I know what, you know, how to create a win-win transaction, because I know what they're focused on. Particularly, it can change. And I know, at, you know, depending on where the winds are falling, what the priorities are in any particular year, there might be better times to negotiate than others. But I think, I don't know that they've done things for me they wouldn't do for others, but I think I do know what's important to them. And so what creates a win for them internally and could create a win for my investors, I understand that calculation pretty well, because I have insights into how they value deals and how they're thinking about the world. And, you know, frankly, I used to be able to run their valuation models, and I present to the senior most investment committee. So I understand how that, you know, how they're valuing things. And often to figure out how to get the best deal, it's okay, well, they value it that way, I value it totally different. And so is there a way to create a situation where both sides, you know, perceive that they won based on the way they view the world?
When you are hiring people from organizations that you think have a great way that they're doing things or very high culture, how does that jive with the other part of you that I think often likes to take the path less traveled, meaning philosophy major, not a business school major? So how do you get those people from the bigger, more established organizations, but then find the ones that kind of have that little extra edge, maybe that want to do something slightly different, but that were, you know, took some of the good teachings along the way?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think if I kind of go back to my 20s and early 30s, I spent a lot of time studying what great leaders do and what are the common traits. And I actually thought, you know, when I launched that investigation, which a lot of people do, I thought there'd be more commonality on some of it. It's not uniform. I mean, there's people that are very successful that are bad people. There's obviously successful people that are good people. Obviously, ambition's a common theme. But the person I think I learned the most from in studying is Bill Marriott, because I understand, and I have a good history of that company and the leaders they've had over the, you know, since the 70s, really, pretty good handle on it. And he has an amazing ability to pick talent and to pick diverse people at different times, from Steve Bollenbach to Arnie Sorensen to, you know, he took Arnie, who was, I think, 36 months before he was CFO of Marriott, he was working for Latham as a litigator, not a person you put in as chief financial officer, but to see that talent. The difference between a Steve Bollenbach or a Bill Shaw as CFO before, I mean, these are wildly different people. But I think learning, and it's one of the things I most respect, is I think so many CEOs and leaders of organizations pick people like them, and they assemble teams which are kind of in their image, the things they think are important. And I think the ability to put together different leaders, diverse opinions, and to understand that different life cycles, you need different people. I learned from Bill Marriott, and that's one of the things I've really tried to emulate, is finding people from different backgrounds. And I think that's helped our organization provide different perspectives and kind of grow depending where we were in our life cycle of the organization.
So you kind of mentioned that you walked into Bill Marriott's office and asked him for $42 million. What's the full story behind why you wanted to get into the real estate investment business and out of the brand business?
Well, I think the brand business model is a fantastic business model. I mean, what Marriott has built, or Hilton has, the asset light model, is a terrific business model. When I was 13 or 14, I was in the backseat of my dad's car. We were driving to the beach, and he had this series of cassettes. This is probably the early 80s. And it was 30-minute biographies of successful business people. And he was listening to it. And one of these profiles, and, you know, it would be the Thomas Edison's and Henry Ford's, but one of the profiles was Zeckendorf, who's a very famous developer. And it told it in great tale how he, you know, got the UN and moved it to New York only through his great efforts and reorganized portfolios and built downtown Denver and did these amazing things. And I thought that just resonated and seared into my neuron wiring that was a great way to spend your life and actually impact people's lives. You could feel it, see it, touch it, kind of change the world. And so the pool of real estate and impacting people's lives just since that age has always been kind of magnetic north in what I wanted to do. So that's, you know, that's why I've been drawn to real estate throughout my career.
And why did you want to start a REIT as opposed to doing single deals or creating a private equity firm?
Yeah, so the origin story is I was at Marriott. 9/11 occurred, obviously a terrible event for our country and a terrible event in the lodging industry, and there was a lot of distress. And because I was on point dealing with a lot of third-party buyers of real estate, the Whitehalls and Mesrefs at the time were the largest buyers. There, a lot of people were coming to my office and saying, hey, we have this owner who's in distress, or we did a mezz loan and now it's underwater. Can you go out and find a third party to kind of rescue this? Because that'd be obviously better for Marriott to have a financially sound owner. And I went out there, and no one wanted to do long-term deals at that time. This is a different era, but no one would do deals that had more than 7 years term on either the franchise or managed side, which is, you know, counter to what Marriott's whole business model of trying to get long-term agreements was. And Host Marriott at that time under Terry Golden was diversifying away from Marriott, so they weren't a partner. So you had this opportunity set of this distressed real estate, and you didn't have any organizations out there that were going to take advantage of it. So the white paper that I drew up while I was at Marriott was, we need to create, there's this hole in the capital markets, and there's this opportunity set, and we should create a vehicle to take advantage of it. And whether that's creating a private fund or a public vehicle, we should explore those and figure out, you know, in this environment, what's optimal. At that time, 2003, 2004, there was a lot of REITs formed. It was a very fertile time in the market, the capital markets for that. So that was the lowest cost capital to take advantage of opportunities. And as you know, lowest cost of capital wins the deal.
It does win the deal. No one talks about anyone else buying hotels except for REITs. So brokers will say, the REITs are in the market, they're buying now. But you never hear like, Starwood and Blackstone's are in the market. It's always the REITs, because they have the best source of capital. And maybe that's a good intro to talk about, because one of the things I've learned from you actually is how different you as a REIT CEO and a leader in the industry thinks about hotel investments versus a vertically integrated owner operator like I do. So maybe you can talk through for everyone how you think about investing in hotel real estate and how that might be different from other types of hotel investors.
Yeah, I mean, I think the alternative investors, funds, and even most institutions are kind of a 5 to 7 year hold period. We buy real estate in a REIT format with the going in premise that we're a forever holder, right? That it's a 10 to 20 year hold. And so how we invest capital, how we treat the assets, it's just different. That different mindset as we're looking for it. So, you know, we're looking for durable long-term assets and not for what's going to appreciate the most just in the first 3 or 4 years. So we're chasing something that's different. I will say REITs have evolved in the investment community. Expectations have changed and evolved over the last 20 years. Pre-GFC, so really 06, 07, 05 even, they wanted the most alpha. So the more renovations you had, the more repositionings, the more, you know, you could say I'm going to outperform the industry through these like really incredible turnarounds, the more they would pay for your stock and the greater multiple. After the GFC, it's almost like the entire investment community got PTSD. They got much more risk averse. And since 2009, as soon as you announce a big renovation, your stock sells off and then people buy in when it's done. So they want much less of that. So I think the assets we chase now versus pre-GFC, I'll call those two different eras, much less of the turnaround assets, much less of, you know, we'll have no cash flow for 2 years and then it'll be great. That's just not what our investors want today.
What kind of an advantage does having a long-term focus give you over other investors?
Well, I think it's the cost of capital gives us the biggest advantage, right? We don't need to get to a 20% IRR on our assets. We can keep low leverage, which, you know, clearly gives us a better position in the volatile industry that we're in during the down periods. We can make capital allocation decisions on renovations for, you know, keeping them up for the long term. If I was running a fund, I would often probably put initial capital in and then nothing until the date I sell it. We think about just methodically, how do we manage a portfolio and just renovate it so we don't do too much in any 1 year, but maintain them in first-rate organization. That's a very different kind of mindset.
One of the things I've also learned from you is whenever you are undertaking a capital project or renovation, you articulate in your materials to your investors what the IRR is on that renovation, or specifically what the ROI is on that renovation. Why do you do that? And why is that important for your investors?
Yeah, I mean, we treat our investors, they're our partners, even though they trade in and out of the stock. So we try to present to them like you would if you had, you know, limited partners around your table. This is what we're doing with your capital. And this is why we're good capital allocators. Part of our mission is to communicate to them in a mature way of what we're doing with the capital. The second is to convince them that we're good capital allocators and we're creating NAV accretion and we're doing more of it than our peers. So if you're going to make a choice to invest between DiamondRock and the other full service lodging REITs out there, say, well, these folks are smart. They're doing deals that are, you know, 18, 20% IRRs. They're probably likely to outperform. And so if I'm going to make an investment in a lodging company, we're going to choose DiamondRock. So it's partly communication and it's partly relative sales pitch, trying to communicate to them that, you know, we're making good capital allocation decisions. And yeah, the other thing is it's a public company. And so we want to be transparent. And it also holds our team accountable to the results that we promise. You know, you gave us money. We said we're going to do this. And we said we get these returns. And we often go back and do case studies. And this is how we did. And you know, usually we hit them. We don't always. But, you know, we're public in our results. Every quarter we put out every hotel results so people can track them on their own. And, you know, I think investors are sophisticated. I mean, they know you're going to have some home runs. You're going to have some misses. You know, hopefully it averages out to doubles and triples. But, you know, it's just transparency is really the answer.
What is the biggest challenge with having investors, partners, analysts with kind of a daily voting machine where they can tell you whether they like what you're doing or not like what you're doing on any given day. And they might not have the same long-term perspective that you have. What are some of the challenges you face with that type of setup?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest challenge is, and kind of the a little bit of the Achilles heel of the model, is they give you peak multiples at all the wrong. They give you all the money in the world and a huge valuation just when the market's overheated. It's probably the worst time to buy. And then when it's down and it's the best time to deploy capital, they give you nothing and your stock trades down. So in that way, the model is kind of backwards. To take advantage of it, what you do is you just keep your balance sheet super low and keep the dry powder so you can make investments despite what your stock price might be at the right moments in the cycle. But it definitely leads you to have a lower leverage level. So you have that reserve of dry powder to deploy when the markets are closed to you. And that's a little bit of the adjustment you need to make. And the experience of having done it for a long time gets you that hard-earned wisdom.
Do you view DiamondRock as a contrarian investor? So are you buying when the markets are tough and other people are selling? Or do you think that you're buying with momentum as a result of the opinion of the stock?
We keep our balance sheet with capacity to buy when others don't have a balance sheet. And we think that that's a big advantage. But with that said, sometimes it's better to buy our stock if it's cheap than buy assets. So we have that ability on capital allocation. And then I would also say our investors don't want us to swing for the fence in scary times. You know, like right now, I think making a huge bet on San Francisco may work out, may not. I don't think that's what public REIT investors want us doing. They don't want us saying, hey, it could be a zero or it could be a 25. They're like, I'll take a 12 to 15. And I want to take much less risk. Now, I'll pay you a better premium to take less risk and give me good solid returns than to swing for the fence. If I want to do that, I'll put in an opportunity fund. I'll take on more leverage. That's a different, I might have a pile of money for that, but that's not what I'm giving you money to do. So don't be a cowboy and do something kind of out of character, because that's not what I want from you.
Can you talk about how you finance deals? Because it's very different from how private investors finance deals. And it's really interesting for those that don't know.
Yeah, again, it's a cost of capital game, right? So where do you get the most efficient financing? And that changes over time. So right now, we're using primarily corporate debt, whether that's term loans or a revolver, generally priced at something like SOFR plus 140. If you were going to do CMBS or bank loans, right, it's going to be twice that spread. Yeah, so you see where the lowest cost of capital is, and that's where you leverage that vehicle as much as you possibly can to get the kind of the CAPM model advantage. And so right now you'll see the public, and they'll all do the same thing because a lot of us have the same avenues, but right now that's the cheapest cost of capital. That's the one that we're most focused on. But 18 months from now, maybe high yield deals, but you're trying to preserve flexibility, which you lose with like CMBS debt. So, we can do things on the corporate debt that you can't do if you're private. And I think with generally the public REITs run at pretty low leverage levels, so we can do things that the banks are excited about. Our leverage level is about 30% of our asset value. So, we're a great credit. We pay a lot of fees through other, other avenues when we do other events. So we're a great client for the banks. But, it's a long-term game for them. I think the credit's easy from their perspective. And then the other fee events are enticing for the banks. So we're, it's a good place to be from the debt side and attracting low cost capital.
How has your strategy changed since COVID, or maybe even a little before COVID?
So about a decade ago, we made the decision to, and I think we were the first lodging REIT to really do this, but really go into leisure. We believe that the trend line, even before COVID, was very much that leisure was going to outperform. the consumers valuing experiences more and more. I think, you know, if you kind of go back to 2007 when the iPhone was introduced, that was really the turning point. And then you can talk about 2 years later, Instagram and the other social media is coming on, and continue to believe that travel commands a higher, leisure travel commands a higher and higher percentage of the wallet. And I think that trend continue. And I think what COVID did is that it kind of pulled forward that trend, you know, probably 5 years worth of, it was already happening, but pulled it forward. So I think we were on the right trend line. Obviously, some of those resorts exploded in demand during COVID and are leveling out. But I think they're still, you know, compared to urban assets, still dramatically higher than they were in 2019 pre-COVID. And we continue to believe that that is the best place to have capital allocated long term. And so that is a strategy we adopted before, but it continues to be the strategy line that we think is the best for over the next 10 years.
What about it is so good or makes the opportunity so compelling?
I'll say threefold. So one, the supply backdrop's fabulous in most of these resort markets. So we have resorts next to national parks or in markets like the Florida Keys, where by law, you can't add another unit. So if you think about making a 10-year investment, fair, that's a forever hold, 10 years, and think about what the impact of having sub 1% supply or even zero supply in some of these markets, that's a dramatic risk mitigator on demand and the ability to grow profits. So that's a enormous piece. The second is based as what I was just mentioning, is we believe that the kind of alpha versus industry average and demand is going to be on the leisure side, partly be social media and some of those growing trends. So that's the second prong. And then the third would be that a lot of these resorts are non-institutionally held. So we have more, I don't want to say less sophisticated sellers, but sellers that are more likely to do off-market transactions, and where we may be able to create value by putting in best practices around asset management and operations, modern systems, and some pretty low-hanging fruit. So we can find more of those opportunities in some of these resort markets. And so we believe for those three reasons that it's a pretty powerful investment thesis.
As a public company, is off-market transactions, either on the buy side or the sell side, more challenging? Or do you have flexibility to do that without creating a marketplace, either selling something or buying something?
Interesting question. Well, I think the one of the big advantages we have is everyone knows that we have a ton of money, right? It's when we call someone up, you could say, you can go on your Google browser right now and look us up and see our balance sheet. And, you know, I have $200 million in cash sitting right here. So the certainty of execution is an enormous advantage. You know, if you're a private fund, you can say, you can make statements, but there's always skepticism. Being a public company and, you know, a multi-billion-dollar public company, that credibility carries a lot of weight. Because if you put in the psychology of a lot of these, I'll call it owner-operated resorts, particularly where we've had great success doing off-market transactions, you know, often they live in the community, they know all the employees, they know a lot of the customers. The idea of going to the market and having that word leak out and having their employees freak out, having their customers freak out, is a terrifying prospect for them. So if they can deal with someone off market who has high certainty of closing without creating that consternation at a fair price, they're likely to take that. Where if you had a Blackstone or a big institutional owner, they're going to hire a broker, they're going to go out to 200 people, they're going to run a marketed process and get the highest potential last dollar bid. It's a different dynamic. So we found that to be advantageous in securing deals that really are great deals for us, but also address the needs of those kind of sellers.
Everyone knows what's going on in office, and there's, you know, class B and C product in suburban markets that maybe was built in the 80s or 90s, where it's not inspiring. Probably people don't want to work there and you're not really sure what they're going to do. There's also some hotels that kind of fit in that category. Maybe it's a limited service asset. Maybe it's an older full service asset. Do you have a sense as to what's going to happen with those? And if you weren't in a REIT structure, do you view that as an opportunity, or is it not really even worth the headache because maybe that kind of class evaporates and that traveler really is not ever coming back that was using those assets?
Yeah, I think it's obsolete hotels. Often a very difficult market makes hotels obsolete, and a good market can make hotels that might physically seem obsolete viable. So if you take, San Francisco or Portland right now, they're very, they're very down in the demand, and they have a lot of things going against them, and they have very expensive labor markets and regulations and other things that make a lot of the hotels just not profitable. A lot of zero profit hotels in those markets. Even some decent, physical assets that just, given the structure of labor and other things, can't make positive cash flow or enough to be viable given the capital need over the years. So what happens to those? I think they survive. I think they get repriced. I think, they'll be shockingly low per key numbers, but I think they move on through opportunity funds and family offices. There's always going to be, some hotels that get, knocked down, converted. It's obviously been more prevalent in the lowest, what I'll call the lowest economy, has the highest turn of those kind of obsolescence. But, New York, for instance, who would have thought you'd have 7,000 rooms in mostly obsolete hotels taken up by migrants, and they're paying an incredibly high rate. And those are very profitable hotels now. So, things change in unanticipated ways, but there are certainly assets and markets that are tough assets that are going to be tough to be very profitable over the next decade.
What is the opportunity set that if you weren't running the REIT, you'd be investing in over the next 3 years right now in hospitality? Is there a blank space that you think is really interesting that just doesn't make sense for the REIT?
It depends. I mean, I think there's a number of good strategies. It depends how much risk you want to take. I mean, I think a low risk proposition right now on brands, new AC hotels seem to have the highest hit rate right now on kind of the risk-adjusted return of success. I think some of these new extended stay brands, traditionally Residence Inn's been one of the powerhouse risk-adjusted returns in our space. Hamptons would be another one. So I think those, the new versions of those with Marriott and Hilton, the two most powerful engines, would probably be very safe bets. And if I was, retired with a pool of capital and just trying to make safe bets, those would probably be my top risk-adjusted investments.
What's the biggest challenge in acquiring some of these experiential lifestyle hotels that are in these kind of remote resort environments that you've been focusing on recently?
They're hard to find. I mean, there are hundreds of them in micro markets, and some of which you've heard of and some of which you haven't. We just bought our last asset in Prey, Montana. That wasn't top of our list, but is fantastic. So I think it's just uncovering them, and a lot of these assets people hold for 50 years. They just don't trade as with great volumes. So, I think uncovering them is the first one, and then executing them. There's a transitional risk with taking over an owner operator who's kind of done it on the back of a napkin and making sure that the transition goes smoothly. And sometimes that's hard to implement. And then, it depends on the individual circumstance. Sometimes everyone's been like a family, so you got to come in there and make sure you're not the big institution and, keep that continuity and keep the associates happy and keep the clients coming back and that you don't change things too much. And those are all challenges. And, I'd say the other on the lifestyle hotels is keeping F&B concepts fresh and hip, not for 1 year, 2 years, but for 10 years it's a challenge. It's very hard to keep a hot F&B restaurant for more than a 5 year period. So that continues to be a challenge in the portfolio.
Is there a secret to that? Anything you've learned along the way?
I mean, what we've leveraged in the last, I'd say 5 or 6 years, is leaned in much harder to licensing with the celebrity chefs. And that seems to have been helpful. So the Richard Sandovals and Michael Minas of the world, if they have a TV show, it seems to be good. But they're incentivized to stay out, stay fresh with menu choices, concepts, right? They have a business that relies on staying fresh and hip. And so that you have someone you're partnered with, essentially, that their entire lifeblood is making sure that their brand doesn't get old and their restaurant concepts don't get old. And that seems to have been helpful versus trying to do it on our own.
What have you found the best way to structure those deals?
It depends a little bit on the labor market. We've done, I think, every variation. So it depends very much on the labor market that we're in and then the type of hotel. You know, we've leased some hotel, some restaurants. We've done a number of license agreements. We've done some where they come in and it's kind of a profit sharing arrangement. But it really depends on the hotel, the labor market, the individual situation. We have every variation depending on what the business case is.
You're a public company, so I don't know how much you can divulge, but I'd love to know what your business plan is and what the strategy is and maybe a little bit of the story behind the hotel you recently acquired in Montana, because it seems like a huge opportunity. It's hard to get to, probably hard to execute, and would love to know what the plan is.
So strategy is pretty straightforward. We continue to buy in, you know, we're in most major markets. So we have New York, Chicago, Boston, DC, but we have a enormous, you know, more than half our assets are resorts. Continue to lean into those for the reasons we talked about. The Chico Hot Springs Resort that we bought in Paradise Valley in Montana was, you know, it's 750 acres. We only utilize about 20 acres of it. And we have enormous water rights and expansion opportunities there. But we bought in the trailing 8-gap. It's a great asset. It'd be very hard for anyone to replicate it. And so there, you know, we buy a, let's call it a single or a double, and we have the opportunity for a home run. We could add, you know, hundreds of cabins, I guess, but be very methodical about studying that opportunity. I think the nice thing about these kind of assets, even if you're buying something that's a, I'll call a double, is you have the chance for a home run. Now we'll evaluate it and maybe we'll do more cabins, maybe we won't, but at least we have the chance for it to be, you know, to double our money on that asset. And you don't get, you know, you were going back and asked me the question of, you know, what are safe investments and what else would you do? If you buy an AC hotel in downtown DC, you're not going to double your money. Maybe it turns out to be a good investment, but you don't have a shot at some, you know, family office one to do it or some expansion or something exciting that might happen with it. And so the idea of buying these kind of assets and having that chance for the home run, you know, some of them are going to come through. So if we buy 10 of them and, you know, two or three turn out to be home runs, that's going to be great for our shareholders. So we like that, just the opportunity to win.
How have you found to pick a manager for various properties? Because people might not know this, but you don't operate your hotels. REITs don't operate. That's the strategy. So what's the best way to pick a manager and how do you identify them?
Yeah. So I think for 36 assets, we have 13 different managers. It's business case by business case. So we try to find managers that have other similar type hotels that have been successful. So a manager who may be very good at a downtown Westin may not be good for, you know, a wine country resort. So it really depends on the asset. And generally what we'll do is often during the underwriting process have two or three people. We know most of the prominent managers in the country. And we'll work with two or three during the process, kind of maybe hone down to one. And then we'll, you know, when we use a new manager, we'll usually give it a couple of years. And, you know, sometimes it doesn't fit and we make a change. But, you know, I think in fairness, it takes two or three years to really figure that out and make sure you're giving it a good shot. But I think we know the field. We generally talk to a couple. We look for similar assets with similar execution where it's been done well. And then we, you know, we take our shots. And again, We're going back to it's a small world in hospitality. And I think we know most of the managers, not all of them, but yeah, we know most of them. And we know a lot of assets in the country and we know the ones that perform well. So we can kind of be like, oh, we're pursuing that. And we know someone that's got one over there, or they might have two in the area. So that's the logical one to choose. And so, it generally becomes obvious who the folks we should talk to are. And as you mentioned, our structure, it's not really a choice. It's the law. REITs are the only type of REITs that are not allowed to operate their own assets. There's a special provision in the tax code that we're prohibited from actually operating our assets.
Do you ever wish you could, or does being a high quality asset manager give you all the benefits without the pain?
It's both. I mean, I think that, and we've generally been able to negotiate very good deals with our third party operators on the cost side. you know, there's some real, I think there's some real advantages from keeping the, their terminable at will agreements. There's some real pressure on these operators to perform, or they get, you know, they get terminated. So I think that works well. If we owned the manager, we wouldn't, it'd be harder to do that, right? So we might get a little bloated or bureaucratic. And then, you know, the people issues, you know, it's great and we love people, but also it, it can become, especially if you're focused on making investments, it's, it could be an enormous drain on how we allocate our time and resources. And so it could take the focus off trying to do great real estate deals by trying to have a great management company. And that kind of dual focus probably means you're not doing either one as well. So we try to stay very focused.
When you think of your favorite management company out of the 13, what are the characteristics and what are they doing that make them stand out?
Yeah, with a lot of these, it's really the folks on the at the property that make the difference more than the management company. And so our experience with the third-party operators, and particularly the independent hotels, is, you know, the right GM, the right director of sales, the right director of finance, that really makes the biggest difference. Whether it's, you know, one management company or another, we're going to drive better. If we have an all-star team at the property, that's going to really lead us in the right direction and the bigger differentiator. Now, you know, they, we do want good back of house. We do want good, you know, SaaS ones and all the other stuff that they can provide and procurement and those things. But the most important thing is the ability to attract talent and get the right people on property to drive results.
One of the things that I've focused on for the past 2 years is data and information, because as our portfolio has grown, obviously you can't spend the amount of time at one property like you once did. So getting the data in dashboards and seeing that data and being able to slice it and dice it has been incredibly important for me, because whether you like the data or not, you, you know things in an incredibly intimate way. How do you do that as a, as an asset manager? Like, I can do that because I have daily insight into the operations side, but how have you found to be really effective, and what are you looking at to know that your properties are doing well?
Yeah. So one of the advantages of size is that we can make investments in technology and enterprise reporting systems, which we continue to do and update. So both accounting and we call asset management monitoring systems, we've made enormous investments and have a lot of real-time data. Now for us, we're not the manager, so we have to be focused on what data drives decisions and where we can implement and add value versus just get data for getting data's purpose. And that's always kind of the trick of it, is making sure you're not getting so much data that's not actionable that you get kind of paralyzed. So basically we look at, we're always very focused on cost controls and what's going on with the cost of the properties, because that is a place where we can gently apply pressure, make sure that things are run tight and that, that the, all those metrics look good. And then,
and are you looking at flow or margins when you talk about cost?
Flow generally. I mean, and we look at individual cost categories. And certainly the controllable ones are where we're the most focused. And then I think on sales, it's really weekly sales costs and seeing, you know, are they gaining share? Are they losing share? Do we have the right strategy? And making joint decisions based on the data about how much risk we want to take, which is kind of a business judgment about, okay, do we want to group up and take less transient rate? Or maybe we feel very good about this particular market and season and we want to take more risk, and we make those joint decisions based on the data that we're seeing, trying to be predictive about how that's going to happen. And, you know, as you know, the data informs your decision, but a lot of that is more art than science.
Can you talk about the art a little bit more and kind of how that's evolved through your career and in seeing all the data?
Well, we certainly have more data in real time than we've ever had before. I think the risk, as I mentioned, I think is just data overload as people become, I think, paralyzed in some ways by a lot of data that doesn't actually, isn't actionable or doesn't create value for them. And I think that's something all of society is dealing with right now. I think the art continues to be, and it's more informed, and it's probably a smaller bandwidth, but it's still using business judgment on what are, and really, you know, to think post post-pandemic, what have been the changes in behavior? How will they snap back? What do you think? You know, right now we're still recovering from business travel, right? It isn't at the levels it was before. There's been changes in behavior. And you have to read articles and study trends. And, you know, we just budgeted for 2024. And implicit in those budgets is what we think the business traveler is going to do in the fourth quarter of 2024, right? That's not really based on data. That's based on, okay, here's the trends and this is, you know, what we think it's going to do. That, I would say, is more art than what we're seeing in as far as science and predictive data. So that continues to be part of our business. And it's hard. I mean, we have we lease every night of the week, and making predictions kind of week to week, month to month, quarter to quarter are tough. You're better off, you know, we're pretty good on a 5-year timeline, you know, and it'll work out to be similar to what we think it'll be. But, you know, 6 months earlier, 6 months later on some of these big trends, those are judgment calls. Like, there's so much that can move the time, you know, some of these waves of trends.
Are there macroeconomic indicators that you spend much time focusing on in terms of how to impact hospitality?
Yeah, I mean,
other than the obvious one, which is interest rates.
Yeah, I mean, non-residential investment spend has always been the biggest one we're focused on. We've had some, distorted policies, you know, with stimulus programs from the government and Fed policies and liquidity. And so I think some of the traditional corollaries haven't been as good in the last 3 years. And I'll tell you, the consumer continues to hold up better than I think they should. So that's been a positive surprise, I think, for everyone. So I continue to look at the data. The consumer is obviously the most important for us, but that non-residential investment spend is over time been the best corollary that I've found.
Not necessarily for your portfolio, but right now, what do you view as some of the major risk factors for hospitality over the next few years?
Well, macroeconomy is always number one. And then, yeah, there's black swan events, which you always lose a little sleep on. Although I got to say, only one major owner I've talked to in the last, you know, pre-pandemic was talked about pandemic. Literally one person, someone that we both know, but that wasn't really on someone's radar screen. So I think black swan events, you always worry that there's risk out there, right? Geopolitical risk and other things that, I think the question I always ask myself is, what are we not talking about, right? What is the risk? It's probably something we're not thinking about now that's going to come to fruition. So those are risks. You know, so we think on the biggest picture, we think those. I think for the industry itself, I think the ability to grow NAV, I worry about the cost of procuring the customer continues to increase, which makes it difficult to grow the bottom line. And then expenses in a bunch of different categories over the next 5 years, you know, continue to be elevated versus what we experienced over the last decade. So, you know, when you think about, can I really drive, you know, 8% bottom line growth CAGR every year for the next 5 years? There's some risk to that on the expense side and the cost procurement side that, yeah, are going to make it challenging. I think there's some other theses out there on the opportunity side that are helpful, whether that's technology implementation at the properties. And I think this macro thesis I was reading this morning about, you know, are these the roaring 20s as people came out of the pandemic for the next decade, having been deprived of travel? Does that resonate with people in a very powerful way? And does it last longer than we anticipate? And is travel going to be against a very modest supply increase? Does that demand backdrop look great, you know, with that limited supply? And are we all a little scarred from having gone through the two worst downturns in history in the last 15 years? And the next decade is actually going to be a great time to be in the travel industry. And I remain bullish on travel generally, but I want to be thoughtful about the risks that exist.
I tend to think that for the right kind of travel, there's never been a better time to be in the hospitality industry because so much money is going to pour into it. It's just a matter of whether you're in that category. It's, you know, do you have the BlackBerry or do you have the iPhone?
I agree. And it's, I think different, you know, there's different risks with different customers. And so we're all trying to figure out where is the best place to play. You know, it was high-end luxury travel, or it was the best in 2022. And then in 2023, they all went to Italy. So, you know, you need to think about these trends too. And will they, do we under index last year? And now we're probably under appreciating how much rebound will come in 2024. But you know, that's where you become the winners. You try to make those right bets on the right thesis on the right customers. And ultimately that's how you're going to do better over an extended period of time.
As you think about the future of travel and where we're going, coming from Marriott, having owned branded hotels, having owned independent hotels, from a portfolio standpoint, are you leaning or emphasizing branded, unbranded, independent, soft brand more heavily as you look to the future based on traveler trends?
Yeah, I mean, we like lifestyle. We like a little bit of leisure, even if it's an urban destination, a Charleston versus a New York, frankly. So I think those are important attributes. We think people like differentiated products. And so that's either luxury brands or soft brands, I think are going to likely outperform over the next decade. Whether it's independent or branded really depends on how we think, often how the redemption system is going to work at that particular property. So yeah, there's a lot of expenses, obviously, with going with the brand, but often more than offset by the discount you get in the OTA channels and the redemption program, the strength of that. Interesting, we do think that among the brand families, you pay the similar fees, but some are much more powerful than others. So we want to make sure we're only limited with the most powerful ones in the industry and aren't paying full fees for ones that don't deliver as much through their pipe.
How do you figure that out?
We've owned a bunch, and yeah, it's interesting. Some of them have not produced what we thought they would produce. And you know, when we're like, we complain, they go, oh no, that's typical. And you're like, wow, if that's typical, I should be paying you half the fee. So I think we've, and you can see it when you're looking at acquisitions, you can kind of go through the numbers and see the contributions. But that's been eye-opening over particularly the last 5 years to see how much more powerful some of the biggest brands have gotten, and that gap between, you know, number three and number four is a pretty big gap in the power of the ability to produce the customer.
What's been your experience in transitioning from a brand like Hilton or Marriott to a soft brand within that same company?
They're generally hand in hand with a big repositioning renovation, so it's hard to divorce that a little bit. What was the biggest, how do you figure how much was going from the hard brand to the soft brand? How much was it because you put $20 million into the asset? They've generally worked out, but I would say, you know, it's definitely a judgment of how much one was versus the other. We found with the soft brands versus some of the hard brands, particularly the non-luxury hard brands, certainly on the social aspect, it takes the lid off the rate. So, you know, we had the Marriott in Vail that we made a luxury collection hotel. And if you think about a high-end wedding, someone paying $1,000 a person for their wedding, much more likely to do it at a luxury collection hotel than a Marriott. And so, you know, we definitely take those kind of things in consideration in making the brand changes.
I want to talk now a little bit about like running the business and your day-to-day and how you think about setting up the team. I've seen it both ways, but some people separate acquisitions from asset management. Some people kind of combine them together so there's a strong integration. How have you found the best way to operate your investment team? Is that separate disciplines or do you kind of combine them?
We've done it different ways over the years, but I think my own conclusion is that I think a gang of rivals is the best way to go, because the tension between the deal person who wants to get a deal done and underwriting versus the asset manager who has to actually deliver the results, having those divorced and having to come to agreement when you're buying an asset, I think yields a better end result than having one person who kind of, because inevitably, even if they're responsible for asset management, they want to do deals. Like the allure of doing a deal is powerful for all of us. And so I think, you know, having that separation just leads to better underwriting, better discussions, better analysis of what the risks really are. So you kind of dig into them further. So, you know, the conclusion I've come to is it's generally better to have competing people in those roles versus combining them.
Through the acquisition process, you as the leader, what are you putting the most weight on as you're evaluating whether to make a deal or not make the deal?
Right now, it's capital allocation choices between buying back stock and doing a real estate deal. So it's, you know, quantitatively, what's the best use of capital? And then there's the qualitative, what makes our portfolio better and more attractive in the public markets? And sometimes you say, okay, maybe it's a little better to buy the stock back if I look at the math, but I think that we'll do better by deploying the capital, buying assets now because we're a more interesting portfolio. It helps our growth rates and it kind of fulfills the strategic direction of the company. And so I'll take a little bit of that math dilution because I think we're a better company for having done the transaction. But that's what we're wrestling with right now, that capital allocation choice.
That's a hard thing to wrestle with because as a deal person, you know, you always want to buy deals, not necessarily buy your own stock. But is it fun to buy your own stock? Have you gotten to the point where
you got to do the right thing? And, you know, we have to answer to our shareholders all the time. So if our stock was super cheap, I went out and bought an asset, and my phone right here would be lit up with our big investors calling me saying that was a stupid thing to do. Yeah, you know, and ultimately you want to make sure you're maintaining your reputation in the marketplace. So doing things perceived as stupid is, you know, you can only do so many of those. You have a way I think about it, actually the way Arnie used to explain it, you have a bucket of goodwill, right? And so you can do some of these things which you think are right and may not be well received, but, you know, it dips into that bucket of goodwill. And eventually, if you do too many of them, you kind of get to the bottom of that bucket and that's not the place you want to be.
How do you think about refilling that bucket?
Well, when you do transactions that are well-received, and the deal we did in Montana was very well-received by the investment community. They thought it was a smart deal. You know, we'll know in 3 years, really. But, you know, it was well-perceived. And, you know, I think, you know, when you do things like that, it fills that bucket back up or overflows it. So you get more credibility going forward for the next deal. So doing things that are well-received, you know, delivering, you know, we talked earlier about these ROI projects that we talk about in our investor presentations, but it's one thing to promise them. It's another thing to deliver on them. And so when you deliver on them and, you know, you did what you said you're going to do and it produces those kind of returns, that fills that bucket of goodwill, right? You're building credibility and people trust you. And I'll tell you, some of it is when your peers do things that are not what they said they're going to do, sometimes your bucket gets filled coincidentally because they're like, oh, well, you guys actually do what you say you're going to do. And I can't trust, you know, Sally over there. That also can fill your bucket by comparison. So those are all the ways.
As the leader of the company, how involved are you getting in the deal-making process? Or is that handled by your deputies? Like, you know, how often are you getting in on broker calls?
Well, you have Troy Ferbe heads up our investments and he's fantastic. We're lucky to have him. I stay involved in brokers because I have long-term relationships. I've done a lot of deals. I like to stay in the flow of what's going on real time. So I think that's helpful. And then sometimes we'll have deals that come through relationships that I've had in the industry. So, you know, often we'll get a deal that might be, oh, I've known this guy for 20 years. We're talking about something. We're like, oh, we should follow up on that deal. So yeah, there's a fair number of those that come in as well, but I try very hard to let people do their jobs and not jump in front of them. So we have very capable people. I let them take the lead by and large, but you know, sometimes if you have relationships, they come in through other avenues.
Every time I talk to you, you're always just on the phone with someone and just talking to this guy. How conscious is your communication stream with outsiders? Is it very planned or does it just happen casually?
I think it is part of my job and my responsibility to stay in the flow with people in the industry. And if I'm not doing that, I'm probably not doing my job. I do think that is part of what I'm supposed to be doing. So I'm very conscious about doing that. But it's not like I have a roster and I say, okay, you know, it's been 3 weeks and 2 days, and I need to call this person. But I can tell you from my office window, I can see Hilton's headquarters. I can see Host headquarters. I can see Marriott's headquarters. So there's constant reminders of people around. And then, you know, I see people at events. I'm pretty good at following up with people. I very much value relationships. I value people. I enjoy people. So, you know, going out to dinners and having lunches and thawing out with people. A lot of that's the great joy I have in my job. So I'm very conscious about networking. I would say it's not rigid, but I do think it's important and I do value it and I do make an effort at it.
As you look forward into the next few years, what would you like to do less of and what would you like to do more of?
I love my job. I mean, I like various aspects. When things are going well, it's all better. But I think deals are fun, right? I like doing deals that create value. I think transactions that create value make my job more enjoyable. So I'd like to do more of that, but it's really capital market dependent. I like talking and dealing with investors and communicating with investors. I'm trying to think what I want to do less of. I think there's a fair amount of public company stuff, what I call Sarbanes-Oxley compliance and administrative stuff around being a public company, that particularly the stuff that I don't perceive adds value for my shareholders, but has to get done. Yeah, the less of that I can do, that's great, with still being responsible to make sure it gets done right. You know, less is more on that aspect of it.
Mark, I ask all the guests on the podcast the same closing question. And outside of your own portfolio, you have one of the best. What is your favorite hotel?
In the United States or globally?
Wherever you want.
I love Post Ranch Inn in Big Sur. I mean, that's definitely one of the great hotel experiences I've had in my life. If I had to pick one, that'd probably be top of the list.
I need to go visit it. I've never been.
You've never been?
Never been.
You should go. I would say the other one, a different experience, would be Brush Creek in Wyoming, Bruce White's. That's a pretty extraordinary experience too.
Yeah, we share that. That's probably one of my favorite hotels. It's the experience. It's unbelievable.
And different.
It makes you want to live that life and be that person. Like, that's what the best hotel does. Transforms you.
Yes, hard to leave. Right.
Hard to leave. Yes. And when you're leaving, you're in a cowboy hat and cowboy boots and, you know, that's it.
Yep. So those would be two that would be top of mind for me.
Thanks for doing this. It was a lot of fun.
You got it, Jake. Great seeing you. Thanks for asking.
Hey, everyone. It's Jake here. Thanks again for joining me on this conversation. Be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or YouTube. Lastly, don't forget to follow me on Twitter @JayWorzak. I'll see you in the next episode.
Jake Worzak is the founder and CEO of Dove Hill Capital Management. All opinions expressed by Jake and his guests are solely their own and do not reflect the opinions of Dove Hill Capital Management. This podcast is for informational purposes only and does not reflect or represent real estate, financial, or investment advice.